The call is now recorded. Please go ahead.
Shall I do a roll call, David?
Yes, please.
On the call, we have Zaid Jamil, Paul McGrady, David Maher, Mark Partridge, Jeff Eckhouse, Helen Greenberg, Konstantinos Komatis, Olivier Creton-Leblanc, John Nevitt, Kathy Kleinman, Robin Gross, and for staff, we have Amy Settles, Margie Milam, Liz Gaster, and Glenda Saint-Germain, myself. Have I left off anybody? Thank you, David. Over to you.
Okay, thank you. I think we can start right off. This is the December 1 meeting on the URS. The first box that we have in front of us is whether or not the URS is mandatory for all new GTLDs. The ICANN proposal is for best practice. The note says there's a tentative consensus based on resolution of other issues. Have those other issues been resolved? Any comments? Kathy?
I would love to put this item at the end and not the beginning of the straw man. Is that possible? Can we come back to it? Because the answer would be yes, but...
I have no objection. Unless anyone objects to that, let's move this down to the bottom then.
Thank you.
Okay, moving along then, the elements of the complaint, same as the UDRP, the slightly different proposal from ICANN. Any comments on this? Kathy.
Yeah, I think this consensus that the proposal from ICANN is not, well, I don't, it is not accepted. The proposal from ICANN was not the UDRP. So it had ors instead of ands. So at least the UDRP is a starting point. But we were asked and we have circulated elements of the complaint that are narrower and more defined and designed to fix areas that require substantive review in the UDRP. Back in Seoul, the issue had been raised of the idea had been raised of reaching out to Nominet and finding out about its domain name dispute policy. And no one, I thought staff might follow up on that. No one ever did, but I did. And they've done exactly the same thing, not quite the same words, but they've gone back to kind of the UDRP elements and clarified them, made them more concrete for both the complainant and the respondent. And I think it's exactly what we need to go forward with a really fast review of the URS is to clarify the elements, not a lot, but a bit, and go forward with that. And so I wanted to see what people thought of the elements that we had raised or that NCSG had raised, but also of how Nominet has done its work and whether there's room here for something that's more clear-cut for a clear-cut process.
Hey, Alan?
Yeah, I'm a real novice in this area, so I'll prefix with that. Looking at the elements, I suspect that Kathy is right that they need some adjustment, that just saying use them exactly as is from the UDRP is probably not appropriate. Given that, I'm not sure that the proposal that NCSG made is the one that's likely to be accepted by this group, but I suspect that something done offline between a number of parties on this group could come up with something that is a modification but is reasonably balanced.
Hello, Tony Harris joining.
Sorry, who was that?
Tony Harris joined.
Just joining.
Oh.
Sorry.
Mark or Paul, do you have any comments on this?
I'll comment. We have talked a good bit about this issue, and there's three places where during the process where differences between the URS and the UDRP come into play. The first point is on the elements, and the difference that the IRT suggested was that this be based on a registered right, not something more liberal as is available under the UDRP, but that the other UDRP elements should be the threshold to come into the door. And we think it's very important that we keep that threshold the same because of the body of precedent that we have that exists, as well as the other safeguards in the process as the thing moves along. If we try to anticipate what will happen in the future, we create problems for the system. We create loopholes, etc. The next step would be at the answer stage, and this is what I've suggested before, and it's picked up here, that examples of safe harbors at this stage would be appropriate, and I would support that. Beyond that, we have the procedural protections that are in place, which is the level of review, and that provides an added fairness and protects good faith registrants from an adverse decision, and that I think we'd come to an understanding that would essentially be a no genuine issue of material fact on the elements of the claim. But I haven't seen anything that goes to modifying the UDRP elements in a way that I could support.
Is there any possibility that offline between now and Friday you could work out something based on the Nominet model, working with a non-commercial group? Or is this just a plain lack of consensus?
Well, I guess, as I've suggested before, at safe harbors at the answering phase and the evidentiary protection, those are things that are open to have a discussion about how that would be.
As I understand it, there is a real difference of opinion here. I'm getting the impression from listening to Kathy that the UDRP elements she believes should be modified slightly, and I'm like leaving aside the other issues. Are you willing to talk about that, or shall we just mark up to no consensus?
I'm willing to talk offline with Kathy about that.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
But again, to the group as a whole, I think it's a mistake to go into changing the UDRP elements for the reasons I've said, and what I would be talking to Kathy about would be creating specific examples of safe harbors at the answering stage and making it clear to people that what the evidentiary standard and burden of proof is.
Well, okay. I think I hope trust both parties will keep an open mind, but I think we've. Well, there are other people who've raised their hands. Zahid.
Thank you. Just wanted to echo and agree with Mark. I think that the elements were something that several people have worked on with the IRT, whether it was here. Just to add into the BC, would also like to see that the identical or confusing similar aspect and the elements remain the same, because that really addresses the actual trademark issue for us. I think, though, that, and I think this harks back to discussions I've had also with Kathy, is if there are safe harbors, exceptions, carve-outs, those are things that definitely we should look into. So it'll address the NCSC's issues. And I'm wondering if any work on that has been done so far.
Hey, Konstantinos.
Yes. What I would like to say, and I would like to basically say to the group, is that the NCSC proposal does not aim to change the UDRP elements. Rather, we seek to tailor them to serve the URF needs, and this is actually following the discussions that we've been having for this past couple of months. The NCSG proposal really looked into the nominate one, and the great thing about the nominate one was that the amendments that they incorporated were after some years of experience and the mistakes that, they addressed the mistakes that they have been doing. So the elements that we are suggesting is are meant to provide a higher burden of proof for the complainant, as the URS was saying, and at the same time try to avoid some of the mistakes that have been taken and the ambiguities that have been taking place within the UDRP, simply because we don't want to see them taking place within the URS system. Needless to say that I believe that we need to create more checks and balances within the URS system so as to preserve both the trademark owners and the individual and non-commercial registrants.
Okay, Alan?
Yeah, I'm not in a position to argue the merits of this. I'll just reiterate what you said, David, that at this point there seems to be a very wide divide between the NCSG proposal and what Mark and the business people have said, and that in the absence of trying to find common ground, the staff will implement something, and at this point everyone doesn't like what they want. So I think there is some urgency on trying to find some common ground, or we may get something that none of us like and all of us think is worse.
Okay, Kathy?
I hear what Alan's saying, but actually, and I hope everybody's sitting down, I'm not sure how wide the divide is, because there have been discussions online and offline, and I think Mark's emphasis on the answer may be the right one, and Zahid's expansion of that as exceptions and carve-outs. A lot of this will be about the answer and clarifying what the respondent can present that would be considered valid. Nominet has done a lot of work on this, and so I think it's a very ripe area for work. So I look forward to working with Mark and coming back to the group.
Okay. Mark, is your hand still up?
I don't think so. I think it would be more productive for us to have the offline discussion, I guess.
Okay.
I'll take it down.
Let's move on then. The format of the complaint, where I believe Paul and others have been able to work out a format, and we have a consensus. Is there any comment on that?
Wait, is there a format?
Oh, am I?
I'm sorry,
did I miss that?
No, we agreed on a description. The format was on the claims notice, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. The format of the complaint, the note says we have consensus on that. Can we move along then?
Yes.
Fine. This brings us to standard of evaluation, the so-called Rule 56 issue. There's been some correspondence on this in the past day. Mark?
This is set up in the boxes as if they're two different standards, and I think our consensus is that both of those standards apply, and they're two different issues. There's the burden of proof, and then there's the standard of evaluation. The burden of proof advocated by the IRT, and this is what I thought we had consensus on, is that the complainant has the burden of showing the elements of the claim by clear and convincing evidence, and that the standard for evaluation is that there is no genuine issue of material fact requiring further consideration. And I think the combination of those two things are what is the level of protection that we've all been comfortable with. But others can tell me whether I'm right or wrong on that.
Any comments on that, Alan?
Yeah, I think the problem is that for people who have not been participating in these discussions forever, those words are, do not have enough clarity to give them a level of comfort on either side. And I think we need to flesh out. We certainly can't use a reference to a U.S. law which is used in a different circumstance. I think we need to flesh it out a little bit more so people around the world will understand what we're talking about.
Okay. Robin?
Thanks. I just wanted to say that I think we're in agreement with Mark on Rule 56 and the appropriate standards of clear and convincing evidence and no genuine issue of material fact. If we can clarify some of the elements and some of the safe harbors, that'd be helpful too. So I think we're in agreement. It sounds like need to wordsmith it a little bit and come up with the right language that isn't so U.S. focused, or you don't have to be a U.S. lawyer to understand that. But I think we're in agreement with Mark on what this should be. We have consensus.
Yeah, I mean, one of the objections that someone raised at large is this is a rule about summary judgments, and we don't have summary judgments somewhere else. Therefore, it does not apply, and we need to get rid of those kind of arguments and simply explain what it is we're talking about instead of making a reference to something that's not applicable.
Okay. I think in the notes I'm looking at right now, best to remove the Rule 56 reference. We're talking about two things, no genuine issue of material fact, and prior to that, the complaint should have clear and convincing evidence. The standard is no genuine issue of material fact. Is that a quick summary? Is that right? Margie, you had your hand up.
I just wanted to comment that there was some email exchange between Alan and Wendy on Rule 56, kind of putting it into words as opposed to just referring to the rule. And I have that in Adobe Connect. Would you like me to put that up? Would that be useful for you guys to look at?
Yeah, I think it would be.
Let me pull it up right now.
I think Wendy and I ended up saying the same thing, except she said it in lawyer talk.
Okay, let's look then at...
Maybe someone wants to walk through it, either Alan or Wendy. I guess Wendy's not on the call right now. Alan?
I heard Wendy.
Oh, is she on? Okay.
Wendy, are you here?
I don't think she told us she could.
I thought I heard her voice earlier in the call.
She said that she couldn't make the call.
Okay, then I heard somebody else. I was trying to give what I understood to be the meaning of the reference to Rule 56. And
okay,
go ahead.
Let's focus on Wendy's. I think. Does anyone have a problem with the wording that says thanks for this framing? I've added in a few details. Can we reach consensus on this proposal from Wendy?
Yeah, she took my premises and left them
right
alone, and then reworded what the examiner must do.
Yeah. I see two hands up, Robin and Mark. Robin, you want to go ahead?
Yes, I was just going to say, I think that we do have consensus on Wendy's wording here, but I will lower my hand and see if others
okay
do have it.
Mark?
I'm in line with what Robin's saying. I just posted on the comment notes before I saw this a wording that would put the two concepts together. The complaint is established by clear and convincing evidence, and there is no genuine issue of material fact requiring further consideration. To me, that's a simple, clear statement of what has to happen for a decision to be rendered in the case.
Any? So that, let's see, is a standard, and then Do we add Wendy's wording to that, or does that come in elsewhere?
I think we want to add Wendy's wording because she gives a few details that sort of flesh out what that actually means to an examiner and the process.
Okay. Yeah, I that seems reasonable to me.
It's Alan. I also have a concern that this be made clear not only to the examiner, who presumably is legally trained, and the complainant, who is probably legally trained, but to the to the registrant, to make it clear what it is that they have to answer. And to be quite candid, I'm not sure a statement saying there is no genuine issue of material fact is particularly meaningful to anyone who doesn't have that training.
Well,
maybe that's an unreasonable expectation.
Yeah, I think there's a limit to what the human mind can do in this area. It's better to have clearer language that we understand. Go ahead.
Yeah, the problem, of course, with digging into this level of detail and not adopting a real standard, which is what Mark is proposing, is that then we really end up sort of at the 11th hour now making judgments about how we will what we will expect an examiner to behave and shifting some major burdens around the system. So, for example, the number two, if a response was not received, no defense could be imagined to indicate that the use of the domain name in question is non-infringing or fair use of the trademark. So that puts the burden on the examiner to spend some time, in essence, sitting around imagining possible fair use defenses when the respondent didn't bother to show up. In essence, what we're doing is we're saying if the respondent doesn't bother to show up and doesn't bother to represent himself or be represented, we are going to shift the burden onto the examiner to act as the respondent's attorney. And so a lot of these things, look innocent, but when we really dive into them, we realize that they are shifting the burden from the respondent or onto the examiner or other ways doing serious damage to the elements of the URS. So we should adopt a more straightforward approach that Mark's suggesting.
Thank you. Zahid?
Thank you. I'm looking at is my voice clear, by the way?
Yes.
Okay, I'm looking at the issue that example, it's in what I think Wendy has added. And it says, example, evidence for matching trademark registry from a jurisdiction that performs substandard review. I understand the inclusion of this language in the IP claims and trademark clearinghouse, but here I think what we're doing is we're changing the way the UDRP was, and I don't think this is a requirement for UDRP either, so just one point there. And secondly, when we're saying that, the evidence was used abusively to infringe the trademark, to what extent would that evidence need to be provided? And one last point, if the examiner concludes that the complainant has not met its burden or that real factual questions remain around any of the elements, I think the language that real factual questions remain around any of the elements becomes very wide. I think we need to tighten that language up.
Do you have a proposal as to how to do it?
Good point. I haven't yet because I've just seen it. What I will do is come back with some language, definitely.
Okay. Kathy?
I don't have much. Zahid will come back with language that clarifies and improves this, and I think that's great, and the idea that we keep Mark's language as the standard and maybe use this as an explanatory note, so that both are there, the legal language and the kind of layman's terms. But I think I would hope that we could do both sets of language so that someone sitting down to read this without a legal background could understand it easily.
And Mark?
I think Kathy's making a good point and that the legal standard is something that does have established meaning, at least to people who practice law or who will look it up, so we can tell what that is. and then adding some explanatory language for lay people could be useful.
Okay. I think, Margie, we can go back to the other chart. And that brings us to the mode of notice, where I believe there is consensus, email, fax, and hard copy. Anyone, any comment on that? That brings us to notice of contents. Any comments on that? If not, move along.
Yeah, Kathy.
Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, weren't there some, maybe I'm mixing up my straw men, to Alan and Olivia, were there some language issues here
That's
that
mentioned.
You've been advocating for?
That is mentioned there.
Okay. I thought there were some more details on that.
We don't know how to implement it, but the words are there.
Okay.
Okay, then moving along to the effect of filing the complaint. On passing initial examination, initial freeze, no transfers, no who is changes, but the domain name still resolves and other features would function. We appear to have consensus on that. Any comments? Moving along then, time to answer. I apologize. I'm not aware of what consensus we reached on this. It's 14 days with a limited extension of 7 with no answer fee. Is that the consensus?
No, the consensus is the left box, 20 days, no answer fee, I believe.
Yes.
And that was on the assumption that the next items ensure fast decisions.
Okay, Mark?
Yeah, Alan just basically said what I was going to say. Our position was 20 days was okay if the decision is issued within 3 days after the close of the time for submissions, and we think that's possible with online submissions and processing.
Okay. So that brings us to the commencement of evaluation, where, again, consensus immediately upon expiration of 20 days or submission of answer. Expedited basis, goal is 3 business days, detail left for staff to determine. I see no hands raised on that. Brings us to number of examiners, 1 examiner with legal background on an expedited basis. Any comments on that? Brings us to assignment of examiners, rotation within a provider to avoid forum shopping, but not random among providers. Examiners trained and certified, provider has the right to drop non-performing examiners. Kathy?
Here my question, I was wondering if staff had examined what's in parentheses, which was kind of a critical element from NCSG's perspective of what Mark and I developed, that staff to examine implementation option to have a pool of examiners shared by multiple providers. The idea, as I believe we've discussed on the call, is that you have people who have gone through training. They are all certified. They've all been properly trained in the URF. They're all eligible as examiners, and that you, as a provider, you can't kind of pick or choose kind of in a results-oriented way.
Jeff Eckhouse?
Thanks. Just as a quick question, I'm sorry if maybe I'm just missing something here, but on the trained and certified, I'm just curious, who's the certification coming from and the training done on the URS, considering, you know, it's never been done before? I'm just curious, is it the actual forum is going to certify them? Is it somebody independent? I'm just missing this. Can someone just explain that, please?
David, Mark has a lot of ideas on this.
Mark?
Well, Kathy and I talked about possibilities. We didn't really micromanage it down to exactly who would do it, but it could be that a separate CLE body is created. It could be that it's done by the providers, or it could be done that it's created by ICANN. And how it would be funded likely could be that people who want to be panelists would sign up for training.
And CLE, for anyone who doesn't know, is continuing legal education.
I'm sure he am. Yeah.
Alan?
Yeah. I'm a little bit leery of words saying that a forum cannot refuse to use examiners because there are issues of non-performance and things like that. I think we need to capture the intent, and the intent is that a particular forum should not be able to only select examiners who find for the claimants. And therefore, that forum becomes known as a good place to do it because you're going to get a quick judgment in your favor when you file a URS. So somehow we have to work against that, at the same time giving the forums the ability of rejecting people who just don't deliver their answers, for instance.
Mark, is your hand up?
Oh, I was going to take it down. But I think we that was part of our discussion last time. I think the idea was that the examiners could pick where they would work, and the providers could drop people who do not perform, but that doesn't mean reach certain results. It means they don't turn in their decision, they don't, they're non-responsive.
They're overruled by appeal all the time.
Okay. Kathy?
And in fact, Alan's exactly right, and that language was added to the straw man, and provider have right to drop non-performing examiners to capture that. But back to my question, which I didn't phrase very clearly, to anyone on the call who's ICANN staff, has there been any kind of evaluation or even discussion or leaning on this issue? Would you say you're leaning more against it or for it? Any thoughts?
Margie?
This is Amy. David?
Oh, Amy? Yeah, go ahead.
Kathy, when you say on this issue, we've been talking about a couple different issues, so I just wanted to confirm what you're talking about.
The parentheses in the box where the issue is assignment of examiners, there's a parentheses. It says rotation of examiners within a provider to avoid forum shopping, but not random among providers.
Right.
In parentheses, staff to examine implementation option to have a pool of examiners shared by multiple providers. And this is what Mark and I had come back with from the offline discussion.
Yeah, well, we have not had a discussion with any particular provider in that there are no URS providers at the moment. However, I think as Mark knows, I mean, it's certainly, I think, a possibility in that many of the, let's say, for example, UDRP panelists do provide services to more than one of the providers. So I don't think there's any prohibition on people providing services to various providers. I haven't looked, nor we have talked to anybody about the mechanism of having just one pool. I think it would be difficult to dictate to providers who they utilize in terms of who they work with, but it's certainly something that we can talk with potential providers about. We just haven't had a chance to do any of that.
Can I modify? Not necessarily one pool, and Mark, correct me if I'm misspeaking, but that a provider who submits their credentials to, not a provider, a panelist or an examiner, a person, so Mark submits his credentials to a URS provider. If he is properly certified and has no record of kind of bad acts, that provider accepts him.
See, I don't think that we can dictate to a provider who they must utilize as, you know, a panelist.
Kathy is on point with what we discussed. That was our recommendation, that people who were certified
would be entitled to be on any of the panels they chose unless they were rejected for performance failures.
Or language or other substantive issues.
And there's precedent
right.
for this because when we have three-person panels, the provider becomes the administrator for a person who has no affiliation with them whatsoever, in many cases, the third panelist who comes on.
Sure. I mean, and I don't see that there's an issue with that. I'm just saying to tell organizations that they must utilize somebody, I would need to look at the ramifications of that. We haven't done that yet.
Would that be possible to do since from an NCSG perspective, this is a critical element of
sure, it's possible.
Process.
I don't know if it's possible to do between now and Friday, but it's, you know, something we can try to...
Clearly, the ability to make sure that claimants can't do forum shopping is the target, regardless
yeah, and
of
Al,
the implementation.
I don't think there's an issue with having that principle as an you know applied to the process of panel selection.
Maybe the way to do it is to say that's the principle, and this is what the STI recommends.
Oh, okay. I think we've exhausted this subject. Evaluation on the merits. The note says we have consensus on this. Unless withdrawn by the complainant, the examiner will evaluate the claim on the merits in every case, even if there's a default, and especially if there's an answer. No comments? Okay. The remedy is successful. And here I think we have some issues. The proposal that the domain name be suspended for the balance of the registration period and who is requirements, option to pay for an extended suspension. Comments on this? We have a number of questions in the notes. Or do we have consensus on the default provision with no option to extend for 1 year? Alan?
Yeah, I'm just noting as I read this that, although I'm not sure it makes any sense, by removing the one additional year, we get the effect of the transfer without doing a transfer. In other words, if the claimant wants to keep on renewing until the year 2075, it still stays in the name of the other person, is locked, and is unavailable but hasn't technically been transferred. I don't know if that has any merits. I just thought I'd note it because it came into my mind.
Howard?
Thank you. I think, if I'm not mistaken, we're looking at remedies successful on the merits. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Here, I sent out an email, and there's a problem that will be apparent if you're doing a URS as a trademark holder as a complainant, and after 1 year, the domain name goes back into the pool, goes a revolving door issue. What will be the effect of it? It will be just cyclically keep coming back again and again, and the URs will be filed again and again on that domain name if the option isn't given to transfer. Otherwise, the trademark holder is being forced, I think, to pay for the URS and then do an additional UDRP in addition to the URS. And I think that's a financial burden because the number of domain names they'll be dealing with under the URS is going to be substantial. So what I would like to say is, look, this is not just our position, but I'd like to ask other people, do they feel that there is a remedy for that? Is there some sort of a response to that or a solution to it?
Jeff Eckhouse.
Yeah, well, I wanted to respond to that. I don't think that, well, let's look at currently what's happening now with UDRP decisions. I'll need to find this, but I believe that there was a study that did what happened to names that were won in UDRP and that it was some very large percentage of the names were dropped by the by the person who won the UDRP filing. So we could look at it now and say, what are the people doing right now when they win the UDRP? Their names are not taken out of circulation. They have a chance to renew it, and it seems the majority of them are dropping the names. So to say this is something new that we have to address in the, you know, with the URS, I think isn't true. I think we see that what's going on, right? They have the same options. They'll have the same options now with the URS that they have now with the UDRP.
And any other, Zahid?
Thank you. The thing is that with the UDRP, it's just one dispute resolution that you have to go through. But with the URS, you have to go through the URS, get to the end of that, and then over, you know, I'll probably wait until the appeals process is over, and then file a UDRP again, and there's another dispute resolution process. So it's slightly different from just the UDRP, because now you have two things you have to go through.
Right, but the point of your email I'm reading, it says, after it gets put back into the pool and gets snapped up, forcing again TM owners to file UDRPs. But I think most of the I'll have to dig this up, but it was saying that many, after winning the UDRP, let the names drop and go back into the pool. So it's the same situation they're in. This isn't a new remedy that we need to think up, because trademark holders are facing the situation right now. It's their decision whether to renew it or let it drop. It's not a new situation with the URS. I understand there's one other step, but what happens with it dropping back into the pool is what goes on right now.
This is Zahid again in response to that. That kind of information would be very useful for me to take back to the DC. If you can get me those kind of statistics or information, I can at least go back and convince them and say, look, you know, this is a problem that is already existing, so it becomes difficult for us to say something new should happen. If you can get that information, then that might help.
I will look that up right after the call and try and send that out to the whole group, okay?
Thank you.
Okay.
John?
Yeah, thanks, David. I'm not going to repeat what I put in the email. I mean, this was a clear in the IRT perspective have a choice for the trademark holder. And I think we're assuming that all names that might be subject to a successful URS challenge must go to the complainant. Otherwise, you know, nefarious conduct will continue, whereas there are plenty of names that, you know, might be subject of a successful URS that, if back in the pool, a legitimate user can pick up. And, you know, we can't discount that. And to Zay's point, that it doesn't have to be a two-step process. You don't. If a trademark holder wants to get the name and wants a transfer, then they should just choose the UDRP at start. They don't have to go through the URS. Just go down the UDRP road. You know, and if they think it's worth the whatever the filing fee of the URS to do it in two steps, that's their choice as well. I mean, they're protecting their trademark, and they might choose to say, all right, I really want to take down, and then, you know, some time to figure out whether I want to get the name back or not. And again, it's a trademark holder's choice, and we're giving them options on how they could protect their trademarks.
Mark.
Yeah, John is expressing what the IRT's proposal was, and I think that's you know, a good balance and probably the minimum benefit that's important here. But I guess I'm wondering why the added remedy of transfer shouldn't also be available after there's been a chance for appeal without going through the UDRP. I think the main reasons we've had against it after the appeal process has run its course has been technical reasons, but it does better address the ultimate goal of reducing the cost of dispute resolution to have that occur in one process. That's a goal that I think we agreed was important. And if it comes after adequate protection for good faith registrants, that would be a more efficient process.
Konstantinos.
Yes. To answer to Mark's statement, the idea is that we're not evaluating how bad or good the domain names are. We're evaluating the malicious activity of the registrant. And simply because a registrant under the URS was unsuccessful and was proven that the use of the domain name was abusive, the second registrant does not mean, it doesn't mean that the second registrant will engage in exact the same activity as the first one. So it is very unfair to consider that just because under a URS filing, the domain name was considered abusive, that all subsequent uses of the same domain name will be abusive. And my understanding for the URS, and that was very clear in the IRT and in the ICANN staff, was that the UDRP, the differences between the UDRP and the URS is when it comes to the remedies. So if we allow an automatic transfer, then we don't distinguish the two systems. We're just saying we're merely displacing the UDRP by providing, needless to say, as I said on the emails that I circulated, an extrajudicial remedy that the panel is not even considering. The panel is only considering whether the domain name will be placed on hold. So we're about to provide a remedy that we haven't even elaborated on it.
Zahid.
Thank you. I just sort of was mulling over the point made by both Johns, and I think that if the statistics show, just something to think about, I'm not saying this is a position, but if the statistics show that the trademark owners are not actually transferring domain names, then that shows that in practice the risks of the domain name being transferred and not being available to other registrants is limited and low. So by putting this safeguard in case somebody needs it wouldn't be a problem. So I'm going to try and reverse the argument. It's just something to think about. And second is, if supposing there's a URS and it goes back into the pool, could we create a situation where the same trademark owner comes back again, complainant comes back again and says, this URS has been again or is subject to habitual abuse, et cetera. Could they do this without a fee or have some benefit the second time they do it or a third time they do it?
Kathy.
Zahid, let me see if I understand the question. Is the concern that the same registrant is going to keep registering the domain name? Because if that's so, I don't see what the incentive is for that. A registrant registers a typo, and they register it for 5 years. The trademark owner picks it up within the first few months, has the rapid review of the URS, and it's suspended for the balance of perhaps, say, 4.5 years. And what's the incentive for the registrant to come back and do it again?
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
It's not so much that, thank you. Yes, number one, the same registrant. That could be one example. Or most probably it won't be the same registrant. It'll probably be somebody else posing to be the same registrant. It could be a guy who changes his company name or uses a different proxy. We don't know. But the same type of registration, the same sort of abuse on that domain name coming back again and again. What do you do about that? So I'm having to continually file a URS. If the issue is I file it once, but it comes up again, and it's the same sort of abuse that it's being subjected to, if I have some sort of benefit in the second time I do it, it's something maybe we can live with.
David, can I respond?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the second time, you go to UDRP and end it. Right? Why would you go to URS the second time?
Okay. I'm responding. The issue there is that there's going to be so many new GTLDs, so many domain names that trademark owners are going to have to manage, that this becomes a question of volume and cost. And that's why UDRP doesn't provide sufficient a remedy, and that's precisely why the trademark owners are looking for URS, a cheaper method to be able to address this and abuse it, registration.
Okay. Alan?
Yep. We seem to be in a mode of, we're writing rules and we must follow the rules. If indeed what's going to happen is, after a URS, someone's going to go to UDRP, and we believe they're going to win, and that has to be the mechanism for doing the transfer, it seems rather foolish to not put the transfer capability in the URS and stop the extra process. I really don't see the harm if someone's going to go to UDRP anyway, is going to pay more money and then get it transferred. What is the rationale for not just allowing it? This is not a big issue with at large, but it seems we're talking semantics and saying we must follow a set of rules when we could bypass it and make life easy for everyone.
Constantinos.
Yes, I think that we are discussing under the assumption that all trademark owners want to get transfer of all domain names, which I don't think is the case. I mean, under the UDRP, you have the option of either the transfer or the cancellation, and there have been instances whereby the trademark owner is asking the cancellation, just the cancellation of the domain name, which means that it goes back into the pool and anyone can grab it. So if that, if, you know, this is relevant in the UDRP, I don't see why it shouldn't be relevant in the case of the URS. I mean, the same more or less happens in the UDRP, and the trademark owner has the option to choose either between transfer or cancellation.
Kathy?
I defer to the registrars for many of the details, but, you know, Jeff and John. But I think here the difference, Alan, of what we're talking about, what I thought Zahid and I were going back and forth on, is we don't want – the URS is not supposed to be the UDRP. It's a rapid review. It's a way of taking down a use that might be abusive and suspending the domain name, but another use of that domain name might be perfectly appropriate. And, again, the as we know, the registrant has not chosen to register this particular domain name. But it's the pattern of abuse that Zahid is bringing up, and that pattern of abuse – we don't know about on the first use. There may be a million reasonable uses, or there may be, Jeff Eckhaus posted kind of the Rolex example, the inadvertent use, or maybe in some countries you're allowed to give an accurate description of the of the goods and services that you're providing, even without the trademark owner. Like in the United States, there's a big Volkswagen case on this, and somebody who fixes Volkswagens is allowed to say he fixes Volkswagens even without Volkswagen's permission. Another country that may be considered abusive. So here we may have inadvertent abuse. We may be able to have easy and quick remedies for the domain name registrant. Another registrant may have a completely non-abusive use of a normal word. But it's when you get to those cases where there's a pattern of abuse, then you have a quick, cheap remedy. And that's the UDRP. It's much cheaper and much quicker than court. And that's why we created it 10 years ago.
Mark?
I wanted to make the factual point that, that the instance of people electing a cancellation as a remedy in a UDRP action is extremely low, probably less than 1% of the cases. And the reason for that is because the name falls back and can be used again in an abusive way. You know, the concern is real here, but there is, in fact, the UDRP is a process to use that for people who do want transfer. I still come back to the point that after this has had a chance to go through appeal and everything, it seems like allowing for transfer as a possible remedy doesn't cause any harm to anyone and would be an improvement in creating an efficient, effective system.
Zahid.
So I was thinking about this, about what Kathy had said. If there's abusive transfers or chilling transfers are not a problem, that's at least what we heard from the registry says, not a problem in practice. So why don't we just put this in and review this after a year? If it's not being used or it's being abused, then it can be taken out, and that, I think that is the exact purpose of the review that we're talking about right at the end of this this straw man. Another solution may be, and I'd like to, this is something offline people are sort of discussing in the chat, is, well, could there be a provision for repeat offenders such as lower fees or expedited notice times or the remedy for transfer if it happens a second time?
Alan.
Yeah, I just wanted to note that what Jeff said was not that people don't use the transfer capability in the UDRP. I think what he said is they use the transfer, but then let it drop afterwards, so they don't maintain the registration.
Yeah, that's correct. That's what I was saying. It was. I'm trying to find the study. Actually, the study was by CSC, and I'm trying. I had part of it, and it was saying that I'm trying to find out of the thing, but it was over 7,000 domains were let expire that were won in a UDRP filing. That's. I'm trying to get some of the. I have it here. I'm just. On a blog somewhere that they were citing it. I'm just trying to find the original piece, but it was from a study from January 2000 to May 2009 that 7,000 names that were won in UDRP filings were allowed to, they say, to lapse or to let expire.
Knowing 7,000 out of how many would be useful.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. That's just a bullet. That's just a flash number, and I found that it was CSC, Corporation Services Company, that did the survey. So I don't know, I'm going to try and contact them, but if anybody else has a good contact there, I think they did a huge study on this.
This is right. I think that addresses the problem. I think that addresses the problem because if the statistics show that they've been dropped after a transfer of 1 year, I think that addresses the problem that NCSU was saying that they don't go back to them if legitimate users want to use it. So statistics show that this is not a real problem. It doesn't lead to a chilling effect or blocking of domain names for use by others. And if that is the case, I again would request that we put it in and review it subsequently.
I volunteered to get the study from CSC and to contact WIPO and NAF to get the latest head count on the number of UDRP decisions since the inception and put together a little chart so that we can decide whether or not this is a real problem or not.
So, thank you. Kathy?
In light of that, I'll take down my hand.
Okay. I think I don't hear a consensus on this, and I think we've had probably enough discussion. Unless anyone objects, I think we ought to move along. The effect of filing answer after default. We appear to have consensus there, unless there's any comment. And then, go ahead.
I have no problem. I think we need some clarity if the answer comes in, you know, during the examination or things like that. But that's details to be worked out.
That's a detail.
Yeah.
Okay. Then that brings us to the appeal of the decision, where we have consensus, but we need clarity on who pays for the appeal. The suggestion that the losing appellant should pay the fees. Any comment on that?
Yes.
Kathy, go ahead.
In the UDRP, just by way of example, there's no appeal, but there is a three-person panel, and the costs are split, and so I would recommend that as a model for here.
Any other thoughts on that? Robin.
Yeah, I just noticed that on the page under the ICANN default proposal that it said it would appeal go to an ombudsman. So, and I just wanted to reiterate our NCSG's concern that an appeal go to an ombudsman. We feel like that would be a totally inappropriate response, and it's a different sort of mechanism that doesn't really belong in this kind of a adjudication of rights process. So I just wanted to, you know, once again state that we don't think it should go to an ombudsman.
I thought that was a staff proposal, which we rejected.
David, this is Amy. May I speak to that?
Sure.
Yeah, I believe I clarified on a call a couple calls ago that, in fact, an ombudsman was not the staff proposal. It was something that was identified as an option in the IRT report, and we indicated that that was what has been proposed in the sense that it required further consideration. So it's not necessarily a staff proposal as a solid factor of what our proposal would be.
Okay,
because the way it's worded here, it looks like it's the staff proposal,
staff,
the default
staff
proposal.
Part,
so that's why I wanted to raise a flag that would be a big problem.
But it's not in the straw man, unless I'm misreading it.
Can we just agree that we'll strike the ombudsman?
Yes.
There's not an ombudsman in the straw man proposal.
Okay, I think we have a consensus that ombudsman should be struck from the wording in both boxes. Getting back to the appeal, do we have a consensus on who pays? Kathy?
I actually wanted to pose an actually, I think John may have been ahead of me.
Go ahead, John.
No, that's fine. You can go ahead if you have a proposal. That's,
I actually had a question. I had floated it by a few people, but I don't think I sent it to the whole list, which is, does, given that the cost of the URS appeal and a UDRP may be about the same, hypothetically, do we need an appeal for both sides or just an appeal for the registrant? And if the appeal is just for the registrant, and because the complainant can go to the trademark owner can go to the UDRP. So, question: do we need an appeal for both sides? And if the appeal is only for one side, for the registrant, then probably the registrant. I haven't run this by NCSJ. Probably the registrant would pay.
Any Zahid?
Just a thought. A failed URS should not prejudice any subsequent UDRP. And I'm just following up on what Kathy said. And if that is the case, maybe you want to clarify that in the URS process, that if you do fail a URS, the complainant is not sort of considered to be prima facie not having a case, for instance. And maybe you wouldn't want to put that language in there.
It provided the same language for the registrant. That makes sense.
Sure.
But what do you think of not having, about the appeal being for a registrant because the complainant has a UDRP?
Any response to that?
We'll have to think about that.
Ellen?
It may well be true that most trademark holders will go the UDRP process at that point. But I don't really see the need to remove it. It doesn't cost us anything and leaves the option open. If no one exercises it, we've learned something when we go to rewrite this whole thing in 3 years.
Okay. I don't see any further comment. And on the next box, we've agreed that the ombudsman is no longer under consideration. The evaluation of the appeal by a standing three-person panel or panelists appointed by the appellant. Anyone want to talk about Ellen?
Yeah, no, this is on the previous one. I don't think we've ever written down what happens to the domain name during appeal. I'm assuming that it gets put back up during the appeal, but I don't think we've ever documented that.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
Sure. This is John. I can tell you from the straw man proposal, that would be true, Alan, in case of a default. But if there's a decision against the registrant, then no, it would stay down pending appeal. At least that was the intent of the drafter.
Hey, Margie, you had your hand up.
Sorry. I just wanted to go back to the prior point. What was the consensus on the fees? I'm not sure what we put there. So I just wanted to ask you, David, to clarify.
Okay. Kathy, do you want to?
I had made a proposal of splitting it.
Regardless of who wins.
Regardless of who wins. Actually, you know what? I think I need to go back and talk to NCSG about this.
Okay, so at this point, we don't have a consensus. Mark, did you want to comment on that?
No, different point.
Amy?
Yeah, mine was the next point that we were talking about.
That's fine.
Okay.
Well, this is Kathy. We'll have a response to that next call. Sorry about that.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the evaluation of the appeal. Mark?
Yeah, the note there, I don't think captures what the consensus was, in that it says panelists appointed by the appellant. The idea was panelists appointed by the parties. That is, the appellant picks one, the respondent picks one, and either they or the provider pick a third one.
Kathy?
agree with Mark completely, and I don't think the or. It's interesting. I thought we discussed in the last call that these actually both be options, and so maybe that may be what the or means, or it may be a choice of one or the other. And I thought to have a standing three-person panel as an option for appeal, I think will make the process go faster. So maybe clarification, unless anybody objects, of that or to say both options are available, and then the details of what Mark had said, I agree with completely.
Alan.
Yeah, is it clear that we're talking about the same URS provider who's managing the appeal as managed the original URS? If so, we should specify that.
Okay.
Okay.
Moving along then, I think we've come to abuse of process. And we appear to have a consensus here. Is it? Which is the consensus?
David, it's Alan. Did we decide on whether the domain is up or down? I don't really care which it is. I just believe we need to document it during the appeal.
Yeah. John, can you give language to Margie on that? Or Mark, did you have something
to
say?
Well, I was just going to support. I think what John said is the right approach. If there's a default, it goes back up until the case is decided on its merits. But once it's decided on its merits, it stays down until there's a reversal on appeal.
Okay.
Okay. Back to abuse of process then. Which one is the consensus?
It's the one on the left. The left column is the straw man. The right column is the staff proposal.
Okay, so the two abusive complaints or one finding of perjury barred for a year and so on. So that's the consensus. Okay.
Yes, this is Kathy.
Kathy, go ahead.
I see what you're saying, David. There, it's written out two different ways on the left side. In one case, it's one finding of perjury. I'm reading it two different ways as well. What happened? Why do we go to two complaints of perjury if one complaint bars you? Am I misreading that?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I think I can clarify that. I believe the first one is barred for 1 year, and the second one is barred for forever, I guess, I think it was a time period.
Great. If you want to clarify that, that sounds good.
Okay. Mark.
I want to express a concern about the barring for perjury after simply one. I guess it says two, and that seems reasonable, but I think oftentimes the problem will not actually arise from the complainant, but it might arise from the attorneys who are working on behalf of the complainant. And so just having it happen permanently barred after one instance is a bit too draconian under those circumstances. I have a bigger concern, though, about point three on there, where you're going to say if a panelist is overturned three or more times, they lose their accreditation. I don't think it's necessarily apparent that being overturned means that it was an abusive decision. I think it should be that there should be a finding that the panelist abused its discretion or abused its office rather than simply was wrong.
Yeah, Justice Sotomayor wouldn't have made it if the test was being overturned.
Yeah. So I would suggest that phrase, that there's three or more instances where the panelist has been found to have abused his or her office in rendering a decision.
Kathy?
I agree. I agree completely.
Good. Okay, if there's nothing else on that, can we move on to the review question?
David, I just want to confirm. So there is consensus, though, on the two complaints for perjury per same entity would bar you from the system?
Yeah, I think Mark...
David, I think there may be disagreement on my side on that. That's not what I was agreeing to.
Kathy, you wanted more or you wanted less?
No, I was agreeing to your language about the appellate of the abuse of discretion.
Right, but the question on point on the second clause that's in on my screen in red.
I am seeing disagreement among NCSG. Constantinos, did you want to say something about this? That
I don't think that we can. I mean, I understand where Mark is coming from, but at the same time, I don't think that we can punish, you know, the attorneys. It is the trademark owners that, you know, if they engage into abusive conduct, then they are the ones that
yes.
have to be punished. Have I understood correctly? I'm sorry.
I didn't mean that you would bar the attorneys. I meant that to be permanently barred based on perjury, it would be more than one instance. You'd be barred for 1 year, as it says here, based on one instance, but you'd get a second chance if it was only once. The second time, you'd be out. And the reason behind that is that it might not be the complainant's fault. I know it's the complainant's attorney's fault, but the complainant could go to different attorneys and then get a second chance at being a citizen.
And this time warn their attorneys not to lie.
And tell their attorneys to be good citizens, you know.
And after the second time, let's assume that there's a second time, are they barred for good?
I think that's what this idea was here, that they would be.
Paul.
I think that's what it says.
Just a question on clarification. We say two complaints of perjury per entity. Do we mean two findings of perjury as opposed to just complaints made by whomever?
Yes.
Yeah, but it should be findings.
Thanks.
Alan?
Yeah, I thought we were going on to the next item, but there's also, going back to the one on what happens on appeal, the notes that Margie has doesn't really answer the question. The answer was, if there was a default, then the name goes down and it stays down until there's a finding.
No, it goes back up when there's a answer
and
filed.
Goes back up, but the question was during an appeal that we documented.
Once there's a decision on the merits and it goes down, it stays down until that decision's reversed on appeal.
Mark, you're assuming the decision in only one direction. If the decision was for the registrant, then presumably during an appeal, it stays up. In other words, initiating an appeal doesn't change the status of the domain.
Right. We agree.
Okay. Okay. Now my hand is still raised whenever we get to the last point.
Okay. Kathy.
I think what Mark wants is what's written, and in which case I think we all agree. So one finding of perjury, you go down for... You're barred from the URS for a year. Two findings of perjury, and you're barred from the forum for the duration. Is that right? And if so, I think we agree.
I think that is the understanding.
Yeah.
Margie, did you want to say something?
Oh yeah, I wanted to clarify that I'm gonna, if you guys don't mind, not use the word perjury because that means something different than deliberate material falsehood in the next straw man. I think that's what we all understand, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I believe so.
Okay, great.
Okay, then I think we get to our last point, which is the review. Alan, you wanted to speak to that?
Yeah. We keep on talking about a review, and some of us have different opinions on when it should be done. I still think we need to focus at some point on some concept of what happens if we do a review and find something needs to be changed. If the review says everything is working perfectly, that's dandy. If the review says there are substantive problems that have to be addressed, somehow we have to start talking about what is the mechanism by which we can address that. There is none in ICANN today.
Constantinos?
Yes, I am in favor of the review, and I just wanted to ask, I see in the Stroman version that I have in front of me that the review of the UDRP at the same time, well, it's deleted. Did we decide on that? And my point being that we are talking about the UDRP and we are borrowing elements from the UDRP and we are borrowing the precedent of the UDRP and we are using the UDRP as an experience, accepting that the UDRP is all good, but it's not all good. And I think that this is the appropriate timing for to have the URS in place and at the same time initiate or recommend to the GNSO, to the staff, to open up the debate for the UDRP. And I would like to bring that back on the table. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I think we're certainly entitled to recommend a review. We can't. I don't see that we can make it a condition of the URS proceeding. Mark, could you?
Well, I think that's where we were last time, David. With we at least several comments were that. Calling upon ICANN to do a review of the UDRP was really outside the scope of our mandate for this project.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we do have a consensus that there should be a review. It remains to be seen what the outcome of the review, and I think we're not in a position to dictate the future action based on a review. If there's a review that's highly critical of the URS, at that point it's up to either the GNSO Council or the board to do something. I don't think they're likely to just say, oh, well, we had a review, life goes on in any event. Alan?
Yeah, I was just going to say the same. There's a well-documented procedure that a small percentage of the GNSO Council can initiate a review or initiate a PDP on the UDRP. So I don't think we need to do that here. It's not hard. It's not hard to do, although I hesitate to think of what would be involved in doing it.
Yeah. Okay, I think we have to go back now to the issue of the mandatory use of URS. We agreed to put that off until the end. What is the consensus now, if there is a consensus? Kathy?
We've always said, NCSD has always said, that if this becomes a fair process and a neutral process, then we would lean in favor of mandatory, which isn't where we had started from. So I would say, and I hate to say it, that there's still a key question on the floor for us. Well, two. One is the URS elements, and which Mark and I are going to take offline. And the other is the question of assignment of examiners and the staff review of whether service providers, future URS service providers, can cherry pick their certified URS examiners for outcome. And so, well, if everyone doesn't mind, we'd like to wait until we hear on both of those. So probably, you know, I would assume the next call. But we're definitely moving towards a very fair process, I think.
Okay, Zahid.
I was just wondering whether we can put that as part of a note saying that these are the elements in the assignment examiners are the only two concerns that the NCSG has, and that's otherwise they would be able to agree to mandatory. Can we say that?
Constantinos, Robin, is that okay?
Sorry, Zahid, can you please repeat that?
What I heard was that this is Zahid. Sorry, what I heard was what I heard was that the two issues that were keeping the NCSG from making it mandatory were one, elements, which you needed to work on, and the fact that the assignment of examiners is cherry picking examiners. could we say that in our notes that these are the only two issues that are a bar to consensus on mandatory?
Yeah. Yes, I think so. I mean, from the straw man also, it appears that these are the two ones.
Great.
That
thanks.
Seems reasonable.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. We have a few minutes left. Is there anything else that needs to be covered?
David, it's Margie. I just have a question for Kathy. You said one of the issues that's still gating is the cherry picking of examiners. And are you, just so I understand the issue when we talk about it on the staff level, we already have in there that there would be rotation of examiners. So it's not the rotation that's the issue for you. I thought the only issue that was open was whether a provider had to use all accredited providers or panelists. And I just wanted to make sure we understand the issue on the staff level so that we can get back to you in a timely manner.
Thanks. I appreciate your asking. Mark and I had come forward with several recommendations. One was the training and certification of the examiners. The other was the rotation of examiners within a provider, so you can't just take the top person off 15 times in a row. And Nominet does that as well. And then, you're right, the third part of it was this idea that you can't reject certified examiners unless there's some reason for it, unless they're non-performing. So it was all three elements, and it looks like the third element is under review. And so I did want to find out. Does that answer it? It is that idea of taking all the certified providers.
Sure, sure. And I guess the question is, from your perspective, why is that make it more or less fair? In other words, if a certified provider is demanding some significant amount of money, is that a reason that – I mean, we're trying to understand the logic behind why that makes the process more or less fair.
I'm going to refer to Constantinos, who has done a lot of work on his book has just gone back in on the UDRP on providers. Constantinos, would that be fair, and providers and panelists?
To be accredited and certified.
Well, yes. Why that there's been a problem with UDRP providers and a bit of selection of panelists for outcome.
Yes, the statistics show that providers have the tendency to use, because it is a trademark owner that chooses the forum, providers have the tendency to assign cases to panelists that are complainant-friendly, and this is the kind of forum shopping that we are talking about. WIPO, for example, is accused of forum shopping not because it's WIPO, but because of the panelists that they assign to adjudicate the cases. So any attempt to eliminate it, ensure that this is not taking place, is very important if we want to ensure this due process.
And
so,
not just assignment of panelists, but the hiring of the panelists, right?
Yes, the hiring of the panelists, yes.
Okay, Mark.
I was just going to make the point on the way it works now is that, of course, each provider has its roster of panelists. There's substantial overlap, but the critical overlap comes about when a three-member panel is appointed, because parties can pick a panelist who's on any provider's roster for that purpose. What that indicates is that that the providers, at least under current practices, can and do have anyone who is acting and experienced as a provider, as a panelist, can end up serving for any provider. And what Kathy and I came around to suggesting was that, you know, if somebody's accredited, they're entitled to be on any of the panels, any of the roster of providers that they choose, and then appointments would be made on rotation subject to jurisdictional needs and language needs. And then finally, Alan suggested the idea that providers should not be required to keep bad actor panelists. And Margie, I think your thought, well, what if a panelist wants to charge too much? I think that would be grounds for the provider not including that panelist on their roster. That is, they'd say, this is how much we pay. If you want to be on our roster, you're entitled to be on it. But to address Constantino's concerns, you wouldn't have the providers picking or having the appearance of picking examiners that have a certain point of view that dictates certain results.
Alan?
Yeah, I want to go back on something that we skipped earlier that I had a point to raise, but let's finish the discussion first.
Well, we've run out of time.
Okay, let me just... I thought we had 2 hours, actually, but let me just raise the issue. We'll continue it on the list. The issue is raised of what happens if there are registrants that deliberately file late replies to get more days on their pay-per-click pages. And the suggestion was made if registrants continue to file late replies on a repeat basis, that there be a fee. So in other words,
let's take that offline.
Okay. Sorry, I hadn't realized we're out of time. I'll take it offline. We can discuss the next meeting.
Okay. If there's nothing else urgent, we've run the 90 minutes was the schedule for this meeting.
Okay.
And
David, can I ask what time is the Friday meeting again? Is it 4 UTC?
The Friday meeting, I have 1600
UTC.
UTC.
Okay. And the Thursday meeting is at 1900 UTC.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much, everybody.
2000, I think.
No, so this changed. That was initially the. There was a correction sent out. It's 1900 UTC on Thursday.
Okay.
If you check the messages from UFLA.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, David.
Thank you all. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.